sudden someone, I keep hearing this.
I hear breathing as well, and so yeah.
It sounds vaguely apish, Mark.
I am not breathing. I'll tell you right now. Yeah, okay. I'm not breathing.
You know the theme, right, Mark?
Yes. Yes, it's I am a teenage Frankenstein.
That's
and,
it.
And I am writing the lyrics, and you guys are going to hum.
Wow. Okay.
No, we're doing adaptations.
Right. One bad one, one good one. Mickey has picked Prestige for How to Do It Right, Wing Commander for How to Do It Wrong.
Oh, no, you got that backwards.
Oh, I'm sorry. Prestige for How to Do It Wrong and Wing Commander for How to Do It Right. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me with Mickey. That's the problem, you know.
You've just confused me.
Never mind. Don't worry about it.
No idea what you're talking about. Okay. Welcome to the Lobot Lounge, the gathering place for the Gentlemen Nerds. The Gentlemen Nerds are four entertainment aficionados who know each other through various media endeavors, getting together to talk about geeky and nerdy things, mostly in the vein of film, television, and popular culture. Many topics are discussed, so please be warned, there are the potential for many, many spoilers. If you like what you hear, you can listen to past shows on iTunes or on our website, thegentlemennerds.com. And now, enjoy the show. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Lobot Lounge. Come in, sit down. The Gentlemen Nerds are gathered, and we're having a great discussion about film adaptations from different media outlets, either comic books or short stories. I know it's the summer movie season, and we should be talking about Wonder Woman, and we should be talking about Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Men Tell No Tales, and we should be talking about all these great things coming. But you know what? We decided to have a nice intellectual conversation about film adaptations. And here, gathered at the table here at the Lobot Lounge, as always, is Mr. Aaron DeOrive.
We like adaptations when they're done right.
Mark Finn.
And sometimes we like them when they're done wrong.
Mickey Finn.
And just on a side note, can I just mention that Alone in the Dark, they're neither alone nor in the dark. What the hell?
And I'm your host and emotional touchstone, Joseph Otinos. Welcome to the Gentlemen Nerds. Ah, guys, it's so good to see you all again here.
Hey, everybody.
Well, good topic. I'm very excited about this topic.
Yes.
Because there are no end. I mean, if Hollywood pretty much got its start with adaptations, adapting works of Dumas and Dickens and things like this. And there will always be adaptations. I know some people get tired and say, oh, let's get some more original content. And although I do agree with that in principle, we have to embrace the truth that we will have many more versions of the Three Musketeers. We will have many more versions of Shakespeare's plays. We'll have many more versions of popular novels and Christmas Carol and all that kind of thing.
Many more versions of Dan Brown books.
No, in fact, I would say that we've probably seen the end of different adaptations of Dan Brown books. Well, you know, I may be wrong, but I would be surprised if Dan Brown has the lasting effect of a Dickens.
I mean, he managed to outdo Clive Cussler, who has like 80,000 books out. You
know? There's a lot of Clive Cussler books. That's true.
There is.
In the beginnings of entertainment, I think we can all agree, you know, books were it. You pick up a book, you read it, that's the end. But I think we adapted those into a lot of plays as well. Broadway took a lot of literature and put them on stage. And then it was the stage adaptations that became early film. And in the early days of film, essentially they were just filming the play, which was kind of boring. And then people got creative and said, hey, let's play and let's go big and let's make special effects. And then we had all kinds of things happening. And adaptations started to go further and further away from the source material, which is interesting. But when they nail it in mood and in theming and in feel of, I mean, say you read a book and then you watch the movie and say, well, that wasn't really like the book, but it kind of was because it felt the same way. And I'm okay with that, you know? And I like that. I like the opportunity to do it. So for this particular discussion, ladies and gentlemen, the Gentlemen Nerds have decided to each pick two films. We're going to pick one that we think is a great adaptation and then one that we think is not a great adaptation. And we're going to share those thoughts and discuss those with each other and of course, you, the lucky listener. All right, okay, we have no objections. I turn the floor to Mr. Aaron DeRive.
Yeah, so a few general notes first on adaptations. My thoughts on adaptations are pretty much what you said, Joseph. I don't think it is necessary to be slavishly loyal and true to the source material, meaning everything that's in there has to somehow make it onto the movie. One, that's both impossible, and it's also just not really, some things are not cinematic that are written. Just off the top of my head, the example that always jumps to mind because people talk about this still is, you know, no Tom Bombadil in the Lord of the Rings movies, to which I can only say, thank God that there was no Tom Bombadil in the Lord of the Rings movies. That would have been the most stupid inclusion that you could possibly have. It would be like giving Monty Python a small portion of the Lord of the Rings, where they find this wacky guy living in this hut that sings and looks silly and says silly things. It's like going to Camelot, you know. So let's go to Camelot. No, let's not go to Camelot. It's a silly place.
It would be comparable to putting Jar Jar in a Star Wars movie?
Yes.
Okay.
At least a good Star Wars movie. It's okay to put Jar Jar in a bad Star Wars movie, just like it's okay to put Tom Bombadil in a bad Lord of the Rings adaptation, but not in a good one. So that's one right up front there. You do not have to be slavishly loyal to the source material. I think actually that's a bad idea.
Yeah, to the detriment of the entertainment that you're creating. I mean, if you're slavishly loyal to the source material and it makes a bad movie, I think you've done disjustice to yourself and to your audience.
Absolutely. No. Yeah. And ultimately, and we nerds will discuss this, but I actually think if the movie is good, if the movie is entertaining, if the movie is memorable, and like Joseph said, this is key, if it hits the same sort of themes and has generally the same sort of feel and tone, then I think you've succeeded. And I think that's where Lord of the Rings gets it amazingly correct. Those movies feel like Tolkien's world and Tolkien's words and Tolkien's characters, even if they changed it around.
And sometimes the art behind that is to compress several characters into one. And if you do that well, it works because then you don't have 6,000 characters. If you do it badly and the characters conflicted because they have the wrong people compressed together, that's bad.
Yeah. Another example, by the way, is Game of Thrones. Very, very popular series. A lot of millions of fans of that show and the books. But oh my God, am I glad that they have decided to go in a different direction in the TV series than they have in the novel. And the novel is its own thing, and people can always pick it up and enjoy it for what it is. It doesn't have to be the same experience as the TV show. But I like the story decisions that they've made in the TV show better than some of the story decisions that even George R. R. Martin, the creator himself, has made in choices of characters and getting rid of some characters and combining some characters. It just makes it a tighter narrative, a tighter, more entertaining narrative, easier to follow. It keeps involving all of the main characters as opposed to going to all of these side characters that Martin has introduced in his books. So that's another example. So anyway, so my examples of a good adaptation is the movie Perfume, the story of a murderer, based on the novel of the same name, Perfume, Patrick Susskind, a German author. And for those of you who've read the book is one of those amazing, incredible reads. It's essentially the story of a gentleman who's born in 18th century France, whose name is Grenouille, and he has no scent. He himself has no smell of any kind. And because of that, he is not really noticed by anybody. He sort of is this invisible character born into the most pathetic of circumstances, basically abandoned like garbage right after his birth by his mother. He's discovered and sent to an orphanage where the kids hate him because he has no scent and he's strange and sort of antisocial. But he himself has the olfactory senses of a superhuman. He can distinguish each individual element of something, whatever it is. He can smell the smell of stones and water and frog eggs and things like this. He can distinguish those smells, and they smell very different to him. So it's a great movie. He eventually realizes that what he's missing is that smell of his own. That's why he's never been accepted. That's why, and that's all he wants. He wants to find acceptance, love, et cetera, what most of us crave. And so he sets about creating the perfect scent for himself by, of course, murdering young women who he feels have the best scent of anything he's ever smelled.
My gosh, this sounds amazing. I've never heard of this.
Okay, Joseph, we are making a date, and you guys are coming over.
It's a very good movie. Over.
It's one of my. It is literally one of my favorite movies.
It
one
sounds of my ludicrous. Of all time. If you back up a little bit, it sounds ludicrous. And what the hell? Where do you make the logical leap to killing women? It makes sense in the story, and he's not really a hero. So,
And that is the part that stuns me when I read this book. And I loved it. And I think I reread it almost immediately. I put it down and I said, too bad. That'll never be a movie. You can't capture, scent and the issues around smell in a film. It's not cinematic. It won't work. Well, guess what? It worked. And it worked brilliantly. Tom Twyker, I'm never sure how to say his name. He did Run Lola Run and several others. But he found it. He did the magic. He made the perfect, in my mind, the perfect adaptation in Perfume. He blew me away. How did he do it? He did it. He captured it. Joseph, I'll have you and Brandy over and oh my gosh, we will watch Perfume and you will love it. You will love it.
Yeah, I think the subtitle of it is The Making of a Murderer.
I thought it was The Story of a Murderer.
Yeah,
Story of a Murderer.
Thought it was The Sandwich of a Murderer.
That too.
That was the Whataburger spinoff.
Yeah.
Right. It would be a Vegemite sandwich.
That's right. That was Jimmy John, The Story of a Sandwich of a Murderer. So anyway, so that is my example of, I would say, an almost perfect adaptation. And even then, he's not slavish to the novel. He pretty much sticks to the events in the novel and what happens in the novel and the characters in the novel. Mm-hmm. But it is more important to give us the cinematic version of that rather than just sort of, well, how can I make sure that I include all the elements that Susskind? But yeah, fantastic. Beautiful, beautiful film.
What year was that film?
Let's see. I will look it up very quickly. I want to say it was, we first saw it at one of the South by Southwest. No, not by the Austin Film Festival.
Okay.
The thing is, it bombed. Bombed. 2006.
Critics loved it, but 2006. It bombed.
Yeah, 2006. And people I didn't like it. You know, I just didn't understand it. And the character was unlikable. And we get to a lot of issues of like, well, the character's not supposed to be likable. He's supposed to be fascinating, which he is.
It's one of the great concerns when you're taking something from one medium and bringing it into another medium. And not only do you have the difference of those mediums, and we could speak for hours on the difference between storytelling in a novel form, where you're using words and putting pictures into people's heads, and storytelling on the screen, where all you have is what you show them. Right. And there's very little opportunity to put anything internally inside a person's head. You have to show them everything. That's a big drawback. But then on top of it, there's this additional problem of the expectations that people bring to a movie. Real quickly, I will tell you that there are people walking the earth right now that don't like Amazing Spider-Man because at the end of the movie, Spider-Man doesn't get the girl. Now, you and I all know that's like one of the things that makes the Spider-Man movie so great is that he remembers, oh, yeah, I put people in danger. I mess up every time I try. This is my curse. I'm Spider-Man, you know. But there were people that were expecting him to get together at the end of that movie with her. And so I think it's interesting when you have something that's that accurately done but doesn't connect with that wider audience because of it.
And by the way, the ending, and I'm not going to spoil it because I desperately want Joseph. I want to enjoy Joseph enjoying it for the first time. So I won't spoil the ending, but the ending is one of the things where when I put the book down, I said, this can never happen. They will never be able to film this ending. They're going to change it. They have to. Well, they didn't. And I was like, both Lyle and I were like, wow, holy cow, it ended just like the novel, which we said could never, ever happen in a movie.
I'm pumped to watch this. It sounds
amazing. We will make a plan this next week, Joseph. You will love it. You will love it.
Now we need to warn you, Joseph. It is in Smell-O-Vision. So make sure you
know you don't have
I love Smell-O-Vision. Yeah,
thanks God. Because and just in the scene where he's born in the street, the gutter, the area of Paris where he's born is so revolting. That you can just imagine what the smells were like, it's quite good. It's quite good. So that
I have to talk to Brandy, my wife, because she's incredibly well versed on these things. She probably has seen this, and I just have not. So I'm going to be
I'm so excited. I'm so excited to see this with you. I love this movie is one that I share with as many friends as I can because it is one of my favorite films, and it saddens me that it did not do well. It got low, not very good reviews. I mean, and some critics did like it quite a bit, actually, but audiences stayed away. They were like, boo, I don't like that movie. Whatever.
Alan Rickman could bring people to the theater for this
movie. Yeah, not even Alan Rickman or Dustin Hoffman, who are both in this movie and are both quite wonderful.
Oh my gosh, okay.
Yep. Yep. So
that's a fine choice for a good adaptation.
Let's go to the flip side of the coin. My bad adaptation, and it's probably not going to surprise anybody because I'm a fan of the source material, and this movie is renowned for how bad it is. League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. talk about a completely missed opportunity.
We're waiting to be impressed.
Yeah. Yeah, the movie.
So are we, Sean.
The movie is just it misses at every point on capturing the same tone, mood, the coolness factor. It just becomes this empty series of CGI sequences.
But there's the
car. It's terrible. It's just terrible. And you can see moments where like, okay, yeah, I see where they were kind of getting close to the material, the source material. And again, for those listeners who do not know what League of Extraordinary Gentlemen is, it's one of those sort of literary character mashups. I think are brilliantly execute when they're done well. They're brilliantly done, and Penny Dreadful is an example of a really good version of this. But you take characters like Dracula and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde and the Invisible Man and Alan Quatermain, and you put them all together, and then they go off and have big grand adventures.
Yeah.
And that's basically what this is.
Yeah, they basically did the Avengers with classic heroes.
Right.
Yeah.
It was like gathering in, like the Magnificent Seven or the Dirty Dozen. You get these,
these
characters with these flawed backstories, and you stick them all together because they have extraordinary powers, and it was supposed to be this amazing. Because it reads brilliantly. Alan Moore's.
That's probably my favorite, even more than Watchmen and all that. The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen is my favorite Alan Moore creation. But I was so disappointed, and apparently so was everybody. The movie bombed. It didn't do well, and it got all kinds of raspberries.
But it plays on cable forever.
It's one of the movies where especially if you know the source material, you're thinking, all they're going to do is take the words out of the comic and just make a movie out of those, because that's interesting. Part of what made the comic so interesting is all of these disparate characters. And that's the key here. They're all Victorian and Edwardian creations, but they are as every one of them different from the other as night and day.
Yeah.
And having them, forcing them to work together and knock heads against each other and bounce off of each other is the joy of that, Yep. And that movie is joyless.
mean, yeah. It was, absolutely. But you know, there were so many missed opportunities in that film that as Aaron alluded to, just pissed me off. You know, I'd sat there and goes, okay, good. One of my favorite characters from the comic series was Jack Griffin, the Invisible Man, who they did wonderfully because he is insane.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
In the movie, they couldn't get the rights to use the name Jack Griffin, the literary Jack Griffin, because Universal was hanging on to those like a son of a bitch. So they had to change it into this like thief who stole the invisible formula and became this wacky invisible man. And even then, I was like, oh, okay, that's not exactly Jack Griffin, but I'll go with it. I thought for sure they were going to embrace the idea of him doing the bandages at least once or twice. Let me see the band. It makes more sense as opposed to him putting on white makeup all the time. Yeah, and literally, he would go moments like 5 minutes ago, he's invisible. And then 5 minutes later, he's got the coat and the white makeup and the glasses and the hat. And I'm like, just put fucking bandages on your face. Excuse my language. It was so... I was stunned. And then again, he's invisible again. So he must have wiped all that makeup off really, really well, you know, to become invisible again. It did not make any sense. And they added horribly unimportant and unnecessary characters like Tom Sawyer.
Yes.
They did.
And they added, what's his name, Dorian Gray as a villain.
Yes.
You know? And they didn't put characters in that were in the, and I understand why they chose not to put Fu Manchu in it, because that would have been incredibly offensive to put the Yellow Menace, Fu Manchu, the way he was in the book and in the novel, I mean the comic series, and of course in his books, because he's so exaggeratedly anti-Asian, right?
Right.
So I kind of understand that, but I don't know. I was like, this plot is horrible.
That's true of all the characters, Joseph. That's the sad thing. I mean, one of my favorite characters in the comic, Mr. Hyde. And they turned Mr. Hyde from this fascinating character who is secretly in love with Mina into this big ape-like CGI monster that just he's like Hulk. And that's not the point of that character in the series.
No, it's not the point in Stevenson's novel either. You know, it's like a double corruption. It's like two times the screw you. You know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Now he is everything that in the source material. He is everything that the cinematic character is not. He is thoughtful. He has great conversations. He has goals. There's things that he likes and doesn't like. There's things that he wants and doesn't want. But when he gets angry, he's a savage and he will rip your head off and eat it. But that's all they took from it. They exactly. looked at the character and said, that. Oh, he's most fun when he's just saying, I'm going to eat your head. And that's it. Yeah. That's basically him. The Hulk who always says, I'm going to eat your head.
And I'll tell you what makes it all so it's the worst thing of all is that the guy that wrote the adaptation is a comic book writer who should have known better.
Oh, yeah. Now again, I will jump always to the defense of screenwriters and say what he turned in may not be what ended up on That's the good. Screen. So just always keep that in mind. He might have turned in a really good draft of it, and after director's notes, studio notes, actor notes, you know, cuts,
especially for budget actor reasons, notes on this one,
whatever it is, that it may have been something very, very, very different. But anyway, so I've taken enough time. Those are my two. Perfume, fantastic. League, absolutely a catastrophe.
We could do a whole show on League, and I'm going to push forward.
We absolutely could.
Because I want to break down each character. I want to point out that the Nautilus looks like a piece of metal floating on the water. When in the comics, it was this beautiful steampunky looking thing with tentacles and giant eyes, and it looked like a freaking Nautilus. I mean,
I know.
At one point, we should all get together and just record an audio track that people can press play.
Oh, nice.
Oh, yeah, that might be fun. The gentlemen watch the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. Yeah, that would be fun.
Yeah, that'd
be
fun. That would be good.
All right, so moving on alphabetically, Mark Finn, you are up, my friend. What do you got?
Yes, I have a controversial entry. Okay. Well, we'll start with the one they get right. It's one of my favorite superhero movies that is not a Marvel cinematic movie, and that's Hellboy.
Ooh,
Guillermo del Toro's Hellboy. He was able to work very closely with Mike Mignola, who knew him from his previous work and his indie creds. And Guillermo struggled with this for several years to get it onto the big screen. And when it came out in 2004, we were 4 years into the age of superheroes. And we'd already seen like really good examples of movies like the first Spider-Man and the second X-Men movie and things like that. But at the same time, we'd also seen a Ghost Rider movie. We'd also seen, you know, so there was room for error here. And what Guillermo chose to do with Hellboy, which I think is so smart, is concentrate on getting the character right. He's got to sound right. He's got to look right. The only thing that really is going to pull people into the story in a way that we were pulled into the comics originally is by coming up with something that was really unique in terms of what people had seen or what they had expected and give them that, you know. And he was very wise to stick with Mignola's design and direction. The villains in the story look like Mignola's villains. Hellboy in the story looks as much like a Mike Mignola drawing as you can do physically. Yeah. Right. Exactly. Yep. Yep. And there were lots of little touches that they incorporated, from the cigars to saying the word pancakes instead of pancakes. Lots of fun little bits that they were able to work in. But what was wonderful about the movie was that in no time did you think that Ron Perlman wasn't Hellboy. They really got that part right. And they were also able to kind of keep some elements of the story together that played off in some of the later books where we're curious about Hellboy's identity. There were some things in the movie that were brand new to us, you know, like having a POV character not Hellboy. We're used to being over Hellboy's shoulder as he does all this cool stuff. Bringing somebody else in to introduce us to this world is definitely a movie trick. You know, yeah. it's especially when you need to show people a lot of stuff and you don't have time to tell them a lot of stuff. Having this guy come in and he's our eyes and ears for the first half of the movie makes a lot of sense.
Sure.
So you know, while the film itself isn't one particular thing, but rather kind of a mash of stuff, it's a good mash. Yeah. And I don't know of anybody that doesn't like the first Hellboy movie. You know, especially Hellboy fans. You know, we'll go to the mat for it. So I think it's a really good example of how working in that different medium, you had somebody who understood it, understood the differences, and was able to accurately and successfully fill the differences up with stuff from the comics to make that transition worthwhile in our heads as fans.
And by the way, this is going to be a theme that we will hit on over and over again. Del Toro was true to the spirit of the source material.
Yeah.
And I think that is always going to be key, to be true to the spirit of the source material. And right. I think already you start out with a huge advantage.
Right. And this is another thing that I'm very passionate about. I've gotten more and more passionate about it as I've gotten older, because life is too short for us to sit through League of Extraordinary Gentlemen again. And my thinking is that if you're not going to do the work, then don't bother adapting something else. Mm-hmm. You know, if you've got a story in mind already, don't shoehorn this intellectual property that's kind of like that in. Do
on
your
Stranger
thing.
Tides.
You know, file the serial numbers off and do your own thing, and then nobody's going to complain. Because, you know, if anything, what people are going to do is that was kind of like this. We should get that guy to do this next. Mm-hmm. But if you disingenuously tell your story through another lens, you run a real risk of alienating the fans. Yep. And this leads me to my my one that gets it wrong.
So and before you jump into that, I'm gonna jump in real quick. I'm gonna ask you a question because there's been announcement of a reboot of Hellboy being rebooted. Right. As faithful as the original was to the comic book, which I admit I did not read Hellboy the comic book, but I enjoyed Hellboy the movie. I knew the character, I knew what he was about, so I kind of went like, "This has got to be right," and everyone else said, "Yeah, that's right," and I went, "Okay, good." So I'm enjoying it. So the reboot that's coming out, they tend to stray away from originals, and we're not going to redo it the original again because why would we? So it's going to be a brand new story, hopefully, keeping with the spirit of it. What are your thoughts? You have some concerns?
I have no thoughts yet. My real loyalty in this is number one to Mike, and right underneath him is to Guillermo. And because I know Guillermo personally, and so I don't have a lot of objectivity when it comes to whether or not someone else can do it. Obviously, someone else can make a Hellboy movie, and sure, someone else making a Hellboy movie has just as good a chance to make it a great movie. If they do that, they're going to be leaning on the work that Guillermo did, especially in the first one anyways.
Yeah.
So my inclination is to think that they know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. But if you look carefully and listen carefully, you'll notice I am not holding my breath either, because I know that there's one of 11,000 ways this could go wrong and send us down an alternate path to where we have something that looks like suckitude of a higher magnitude.
The one thing that gives me a ray of hope is that Ron Perlman, you cannot top Ron Perlman in this role. He is perfect for the role, but they got as close as possible. They cast the sheriff from Stranger Things, who is perfect casting if you're not going to have Ron Perlman. He is perfect for the character. So
we'll see. It
looks like they know what they're doing. Let's see how the rest turns out.
Yeah. And it'll be interesting to see what they keep from the comics and what they don't keep.
My concern is a little bit broader and not quite appropriate for this discussion, but I don't like that they're rebooting things so quickly after something else has come out. It just came out. Yeah, I have that issue just right now in general. Yeah. How many reboots of Spider-Man? How many reboots of Batman? How many reboots of Hellboy? How many reboots of whatever it is are we going to get really on the tail of the other?
It seems
Go ahead, Mark.
Go ahead. Well, it seems that those iterations are in most cases it's a course correction, but in some cases it's a reboot for reboot's sake. And
Ultimately, Hollywood is a business. Absolutely, that is something everybody must understand. Hollywood's bottom line is money. It is not art. It is not the creation of something that will resonate through the ages. It is money.
And I have to say, as far as reboots go, one of my okay reboots that I was like, you know what, that didn't offend me whatsoever, was the reboot of the quote unquote reboot of Friday the 13th. Because all they did was make another Friday the 13th movie. They showed his origin. Yeah, we know his origin. They showed Mrs. Voorhees getting her head cut off. Yeah, we know that. You showed him with a bag over his head for a little bit. Yeah, we know that too. Whatever. It's just another Friday the 13th movie.
Exactly.
You know? And I was like, I'm good with this. This doesn't offend me at all. We'll change nothing, you know?
What's funny Go ahead.
There's certainly those angles like that, especially when it comes to some of the horror stuff. But in the case of the Fantastic Four, you have there are different people trying and failing, and they're trying their hardest, but they're just not getting it right. And so it can be argued that Spider-Man was along the same lines. I didn't mind Andrew Garfield so much.
I actually preferred Andrew Garfield.
I think
he had bad scripts.
Well, maybe so, But in any case, we're talking about a case of, you know, the second Hellboy movie got mixed reviews, and I don't know that they were so bad that you couldn't have given Guillermo another chance at it, but their schedules and, you know, they've got there's a lot of factors that probably went into why they went with somebody else, and it wasn't that they were trying to piss me off. Weirdly enough, I was not consulted. You know what I mean? Like, right. There was a, I don't think it has anything to do with them wanting to jinx the project by not having Guillermo involved. Yeah. I think it has everything to do with we've got a ticking clock on this property that we've licensed, and we need to make a third movie or reboot a first movie or whatever before.
Yeah, and that explains Fantastic Four too, by the way. It's right. Always when they're about to lose the rights, they say, let's hurry up and do another Fantastic Four movie, even if it's a terrible Fantastic Four movie.
Right, just to solidify the rights.
Yeah, it's more attempt to
That's where we got the start.
Speaking of ticking clocks.
Yeah, this will probably all have to keep be us
on. Yeah, we're right. going to have to go ahead and move on to your negative choice. Our second round is here, and Maximilian's not red-eyeing us yet, but he's standing there. So let's move on.
So my negative choice is controversial because when I say it, you'll understand. It is a film that is an absolute failure as an adaptation. And that movie is Stanley Kubrick's The Shining.
Oh, now, love that movie.
I know, right? Yeah. It's a great movie.
And for that reason, I stated this at the beginning, I absolutely disagree with you. I think The Shining is a brilliant adaptation of Stephen King's novel.
I'll tell you why I don't think it is. Okay. And it has everything to do with Kubrick being an auteur of the first magnitude. He takes over everything that he does and makes it a Stanley Kubrick movie. How can he not?
Sure.
In this case, he has tapped into some stuff that runs, I think, kind of parallel to the King novel. In that sense, I think the movie is an excellent, excellent horror movie about madness, isolation, and fatherhood that uses things from the book without actually using the book until they did a television adaptation of The Shining, a 2-night, 4-hour long
snooze fest.
Thing using it's a snooze fest using Steven Weber.
And by the way, that would be my argument. If somebody was saying, well, no, you know, Kubrick's The Shining, that's not a good adaptation. Oh yeah, watch the TV version, which is much more true to the book.
It sucks. Yeah, it's terrible. It has no life. It has no heart.
Polo Mallet is not as scary as a fireman's axe. It's just not.
It's not. And the hedge mazes coming to life and chasing him back into the house in the novel is a terrifying scene. Yes. Just an absolute terrifying scene. And I saw it in my head the way that you normally see these things, where he looks out, he sees the hedge mazes, you cut back to a shot of him raking for a second, then he looks back up and you cut back and the hedge mazes have moved, the monsters have moved.
Yeah, these are topiary animals, we should explain.
Yeah, exactly.
The maze was Kubrick's creation, or the screenwriter's creation for the Stanley Kubrick adaptation. In the book, they were topiary animals, giant hedge topiary animals that moved and came to life.
And there's a shot, you know, the second time in the book, the second time he looks up, the lion has killed one of the gazelles, and the gazelle is lying on its side, and the lion is standing over it with a paw on it, and he says, no, that can't be right. He looks again, and now the lion topiary is looking at him, right? the thing has turned its bushy head,
right?
And he's looking at him, and when I read that the first time, it scared the shit out of me. It was so terrifying. And they managed to wring all of the suspense out of it when they filmed it for the TV movie. It's not a successful adaptation because it's not enough of an adaptation. There's so much stuff in there where he took minor things and teased them out. He basically started with the bones of The Shining and built an entirely new thing on top of it. And I wouldn't call that an adaptation so much as I would call that an appropriation.
Mm-hmm.
Now King got paid and paid well, and it did very well. And it sold way more copies of the book with the cover to the movie on it. Right. Mm-hmm. So nobody complained, but it really was appropriation. He got a free hand and literally I think he took too much of it. I'm glad he did. It's one of my favorite horror movies. It's so good. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful fever dream, especially, you know, when all hell breaks loose and he's gone completely nutso and everybody finally figures it out. It basically, that's when the haunt is triggered, you know, and everything just goes sideways.
Oh yeah, and we start to see things through Wendy's eyes. You know, we start to see those moments through Wendy's eyes as she's wandering through the hotel, and she is starting to see things now. Whereas before it was always Jack. See, we weren't really 100% sure if it was ever just in his head, if he was just going mad and talking to himself. But then she starts to see things.
Yeah, and I submit to you that that is because Kubrick understands film.
Yeah,
and Kubrick chose to do these things as film rather than try and make it work, you know, take this source material and move it around over here. You know, he's literally manipulating the film to make us terrified. You know, with the editing and sound and all of that.
By the way, the camera work, this was the first time Steadicam was ever used extensively. Nobody thought Steadicam would be a serious thing and everything. And he came in and went, no, we can use this for the creep effect.
Oh, the big wheel scene. Yeah.
But just like with Hellboy, Mark, I this is why I disagree, because the Shining movie, Kubrick's movie, is true to the essence of the novel. It would be bad, as proven by the miniseries, if he had been slavishly loyal to the novel. I think you take the story of the novel, the characters are the same, the setting, the situation, what happens, the general elements of the plot are the same,
right?
But you do a cinematic version of all those ideas of that concept, and it's done brilliantly. I mean, I would agree with you if The Shining was a mess and it didn't work and it was just a terrible movie. But I think the fact that it succeeded and is considered by many people to be probably one of their top horror movies, I find it a successful adaptation.
I do see your point. It succeeds despite its failure to convert the material successfully.
It's not a faithful adaptation, but it works.
No, it's not a faithful adaptation to the movie at all.
Not unlike Blade Runner.
Blade Runner, the same thing, very much so. Because that story is not as good, and the movie is so great, and the story's like,
The story's depressing as hell too.
Which is why I don't think faithful adaptation is necessarily a good thing. It can be.
I agree with you there. I think it's not always clear. And certainly it wasn't back in the 1980s when people were, at the time, there were more Stephen King fans running around than anything. I mean, he was a big legitimate deal, and there are so many people that had read The Shining and were real excited about the movie because they hadn't gotten several of his films really right. You know, that's the thing, is that Stephen King is probably the most adapted author in the 20th century, and we can point to four movies that don't suck. People will tend to excuse The Shining and include it because, well, it's so good anyways. Yeah. But you know, that's the thing, is that if you were a Stephen King reader, you went to the Shining, and even if it scared the shit out of you, you were still like, yeah, but they didn't do this and they didn't do that and they didn't do that. And I thought it was going to be more like that. And so, you know, back then, I think would be considered a failure in that regard, even as they absolutely stuck the dismount for what a modern psychological horror movie should be, you know. Yeah. And we have the hindsight now of looking back and realizing that this movie holds up 30 years later. This movie, you can show a modern audience The Shining, and they will leave with their faces white and their pants full. You know, they'll walk out of the theater going, that wasn't that scary. Okay, why don't you drive home in the snow? Let's see how not scary you think it was. Being a Stephen King reader, and even as the movie terrified me, hating it for a while because I couldn't reconcile how you could take something that's so easy. It's just Stephen King. All you got to do is just put it up on screen. You know, 40-something-year-old me knows, you know, that's ridiculous now. You can't just put
it. And we have an example of doing that, which was the TV miniseries, which just didn't work.
Right.
So, yep. All right. So moving on now, because we're going to run into some empty time here. Mickey Finn, you have two?
I can make up time on this because this is just pointing stuff out and less of a discussion.
All right.
The Prestige for my good one.
Yep.
Which is how you take basically an epistolary novel and turn it into one hell of a story. It's visually fantastic. And on top of that, I often travel and I listen to audiobooks when I'm on the road. And this is the only audiobook I wanted to throw out of the car while the car was moving once the final disc ended.
Oh, my.
The story doesn't go anywhere.
Really?
It's all set up and no follow through. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I know we're on the final disc. What's going on? And then, presented by Blackstone Audio or whatever. And I'm like, what?
Yeah.
Whereas
what is it about? Can you summarize briefly for those of you us who have never heard of The Prestige?
Who've never seen the movie?
Or the book or anything? Give me a brief summary.
Brief summary of The Prestige is that two magicians are warring in Victorian times.
Stage magicians
are warring, trying to outdo each other's tricks. And it gets to the point where maiming and death is involved. And the movie's done by Christopher Nolan and stars Christian Bale and Hugh Jackman with a side journey with David Bowie. And
who plays Nikola Tesla.
Yes.
Brilliant.
And Michael Caine is fantastic in it as well as one of the guys that builds the effects. But
I saw it in the theaters. It was a good movie. I enjoyed it.
Yeah. But I agree with Mickey, by the way. I read the novel before I'd seen the movie. Yeah. And after reading the novel, I was like, huh? and then I saw the movie and I was like, okay. I mean, there's still a huh moment in the movie, but it definitely is, in my opinion, much more satisfying in the film than it is in the novel. And again, we get back to the instance of, I think the film did it better.
They took the essence of the book.
Exactly.
And turned it, and making an epistolary novel into a movie is difficult to begin with. But they did a phenomenal job with this.
Absolutely.
I agree.
I agree with that pick, Mickey. I think that is a fantastic pick for an excellent adaptation.
I would have picked Fight Club. Except I could never actually read Fight Club because I hate first-person narratives.
We're also not supposed to talk about Fight
Club. Oh, that's true.
Yeah, rule number one is you don't talk about
it. At least we didn't mention the eye of the... And then the one that is the what-the-hell adaptation is that once upon a time, there was a lovely series of games with Mark Hamill and lots of Muppets called Wing Commander.
Oh, God.
And then the guy behind Wing Commander was in charge of the movie. He made all the cats hairless for some unknown reason. Everybody was cast very strangely and like acting like 13-year-olds. And they turned it into a sub-movie.
no doubt that was a terrible, terrible film.
Now,
P.O.S. Yes.
Yeah, they started on video games
based on a series of video games.
And the magic of the video games were that there were all these film story sequences in between just a space fighter simulator where you're flying around and doing missions.
The
space fighter itself was fun, but what really made the series was all the work this same guy put into the storylines and the characters and filming, Mark Hamill as the lead character, as the lead fighter pilot and the bad guys, one of which was played by Tim Curry in a suit,
certain choices he made. I mean, the guy he thought this was like a World War II submarine movie, right? So it's ridiculous. They're in a spaceship, and the evil spaceship, the Kilrathi spaceship, is hunting them. They're hiding in an asteroid field or something, and they're all they're all whispering. They're whispering inside of their spaceship because they don't want the Kilrathi to hear them in space. So it's like, dude, you're not making Dust Boat. I mean, you're like,
yeah,
please.
And again, it's the same guy behind both the games and the movie. And yeah. the Kelrathi are like, you know, for all intents and purposes, noble Klingons. They just happen to be at war with us. And the and in the movie, like they're just dumb, hairless cats.
Yeah, they look like mole rats. They're like 7 foot tall mole rats, and it's it's
with no
so
personality,
horrible.
No honor, no anything. It's
by the
like
way, so
he completely
so
neutered
a little trivia question here. We were working at Origin when this movie came out, and so we got treated as a company to go see the Wing Commander movie at the Paramount. The director was in attendance and was taking a Q&A afterwards, and I think he wished he hadn't had decided to take a Q&A afterwards, because people, you know, it was, you could see the expressions, you know, the lights come up, you look around, and people are smirking, they're whispering to each other and chuckling. Other people are like just sort of shaking their heads sadly. And it was, what a nightmare. I would have snuck out. If I was a director, I would have snuck out. But yeah, I absolutely agreed that what a travesty of a film. Based on a series that could have been a lot of fun. It could have been really fun space opera.
It sounds silly that, oh, you know, the video game, da, 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 but this was...
Oh, no.
This was before... This was before Dragon Age and BioWare and all the story-driven games. He was one of the pioneers.
Fun series with fun characters. You know, and that may be another... I want to hurry up and get to Joseph's choices, but that may be a thread that will go through this, is that... When a movie's not fun, you know, whatever that adaptation is, when it's not entertaining, that's when it really just falls flat on its face. Yeah. It misses the point of the source material. But yeah, agreed, Mickey. Good picks.
Focusing on the idea of adaptation, I really thought about this because I wanted to focus on the art and success of adaptation. So my pick for a good adaptation, a very good adaptation of a very good book, that one of my favorites, is the book is Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island, and the adaptation is the 1990 production of Treasure Island, starring Charlton Heston and Christian Bale, with Oliver Reed as Billy Bones and Christopher Lee as Blind Pew.
Not the Muppet version?
Not the Muppet version. Oh. It was filmed in Cornwall, England, also Pinewood Studios. They used the replica ship, the Bounty 2, that was used on the Mutiny on the Bounty with Marlon Brando. And they redressed it to be the Hispaniola. And it is so faithful to the book. I mean, it really, really is. Even some of the more violent portions of the book, making Blind Pew terrifying. Which he was in the book, and of course it's Christopher Lee. So yeah, you're pretty much freaked out by that guy.
That's awesome. You know, I've never seen that version.
Oh,
it's so good.
I must watch it. Christian Bale is Jim Hawkins, young Christian Bale. You know, so you get a little bit of that. Richard Johnson is Squire Trelawney, and he nails the character. Just all of them are pitch perfect. But it's Billy Bones. Oliver Reed's Billy Bones. Who just it captures the whole feel of that story, Perfect. That book, that whole opening sequence in the Admiral Benbow Inn, when him singing, you know, the 15 men on a dead man's chest, and he's just drinking himself to death, literally drinking himself to death. And Oliver Reed, red-faced, staring, ever blinking, Oliver Reed, just pulls that off so well. And then when they get to the island, it's a great adventure. One of my favorite sequences from the book is when Jim Hawkins cuts the cable on the Hispaniola, drifts it off, and then basically has a tete-a-tete with Israel Hands, who's the gunner, Silver's gunner on the boat. And Israel sort of comes to because he's been injured in a fight with another pirate, and Israel says, well, fine, you're the captain. What do you want to do? So he helps him steer the boat and beach it, and then tries to kill him, just tries to stab him. And then they have this whole confrontation, the very famous one more step, Mr. Hands, now blow your brains out, because Jim Hawkins climbs to the very top of the mast, and Israel, injured, bleeding, is chasing him with a knife in his mouth, and it's terrifying. You're a kid, and this pirate wants to kill you, and you know that is done so well in this adaptation. I haven't seen it done quite well. The only weak part about it, unfortunately, is Silver himself. Now, Charlton Heston does a great Silver. In fact, he's very much like he's described in the book. But it's Charlton Heston, so he's kind of stiff, whereas Robert Newton Silver from the Disney version, is the personality of Silver is just pouring out of every pore. He's likable. He's terrifying and can kill you, and he's a murderer, and he's a mutineer, and he's a pirate, but he's charming. He's got a glint in his eye and a swagger to him and a lyrical sing-song to his voice. And Heston's got a little bit of that, but also Heston is, I wouldn't trust him from the first, you know? There's nothing really warm about Heston, right?
All right.
So it's hard, but he does a great job. I mean, and his son, Charlton Heston's son, Frazier, directed this. And yeah, Frazier Heston. And it's in the music by the Chieftains throughout.
Wow.
Yeah, a great adaptation. Very, very faithful to the book.
All right. 1990 Treasure Island. Another movie I got to add to my list.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, and I think you're the only one that's seen it. All the rest of us have not, which means we have to drink.
That's right.
Yes. You've stumped the table.
Yeah, glasses up. Yeah, highly recommended. Now, my second choice is going to be as controversial, I think, as Mark's. Because I love this movie. I adore it. It's one of my favorite movies. I literally have a quote written on a wooden plaque hanging in my house from this movie. And it's The Seven Faces of Dr. Lowe. That's the movie.
Yeah.
The book is by Charles Finney called The Circus of Dr. Lowe. And this is The Circus of Dr. Lowe. We show you things that you did. No, we spared no expense and we spared no dough because we wanted to give you one hell of a show. And it is brilliant. It is The Circus of Dr. Lowe is beyond. If you guys have never read the book, I will force you to read this book. I will pass it along the table. I'm serious. I am dead serious. You will all read this book.
It's good. Yes.
And Aaron, it will be one of your favorites. I know you, my friend.
Okay. I'm in. Because like you, I love the movie.
Yeah.
The Seven Faces of Dr. Lowe. I think it's and you're right. I probably would disagree with you for the same reasons I disagreed with Mark on The Shining. If I love a movie that much, it probably is what I would consider a successful cinematic adaptation. Now I say that not having read the book. So maybe if I read the book, I'll go, oh, God, yeah, it's so different. You know, it's so different.
And truth of it, and this is where I disagree with my friend Mark, I don't necessarily think The Shining was that different. I think it was bare bones, skeleton, you know.
Exactly. No, I don't either, because I did read The Shining. I did read The Shining, and I don't think they're that different.
And this is very much like that. Dr. Lowe, The Circus of Dr. Lowe takes place in Abilene, Arizona, but it's set in the 1930s, Abilene, Arizona, whereas the George Powell movie was like an Old West kind of a situation.
Right.
And this ancient Chinese mystic, Dr. Lowe, pulls into town carrying the legendary creatures from all areas of mythology. He's got a sea serpent, an Apollonius of Tirana, a Medusa, a satyr. But in the book, there's a lot more in his circus. He's got a werewolf, which is a great sequence where the werewolf is there and everyone wants to see the werewolf transform. And there is a female werewolf. And all the lascivious townsmen are sitting there watching this werewolf transform back into a woman, thinking it's going to be this beautiful naked woman that they're going to be looking at then. But it's an old hag. And they go, oh, you know. Nice. It's the same kind of issue where it's reflective that the circus is giving them little bits of themselves. And some of them learn, some of them do not. The movie added a subplot about a rich landowner who was trying to get them all to sell off their land because only he knew that a railroad was coming through and he was going to make lots of money. It added a lot of racism issues with the Indians, and that was reflected in the novel as well, but not as heavily. Dr. Lowe himself, the character, is so downplayed as to what he is in the novel, which makes it better because he is an enigma. He talks in the movie too. They did take this very well. In the book, he talks with broken English. What about you? What time talk? He does that in the book, and then changes on a dime and talks very cultured and sophisticated and mannered. And he's very, you know. So Tony Randall was a brilliant casting choice. And the gimmick in the George Powell movie was that Tony Randall plays all the creatures. He pays everything.
Yeah.
Everything and it's Tony Randall in costume and makeup. William Tuttle's amazing makeup and things like that. In the book, that's not the case, obviously. Lowe is a very distinct person. All his creatures and all his members of his circus are distinct people. They can walk into the same room and talk to each other. There's moments of that. The novel ends with the town becoming the site of a ritual to a pagan god named Yodel. And the ritual ends when the god kills a virgin, a lover, and the priest doing the ritual. I mean, it ends on a very weird, dark note, and the circus ends with this pagan ritual and this sacrifice and this, you know, death of a virgin or something like that. And then the circus is over and the townsfolk just go, okay, great circus, bye. And they all leave. And some of them profit from the surreal experience of the circus. Some of them do not. Right. One of my favorite parts of the book is the appendix, which is a catalog of all the people, all the places, all the items, and all the mythological beings in the novel. And it sums them up pithily and sardonically. And it does it so brilliant. It does. It even asks questions. It's like, and now here are some questions and contradictions in the book that you might have found. Like, was the bear a Russian bear? You know, you know, right. If Apollonius of Tyre was so powerful, why was he hanging out with Dr. Lowe? You know, things like that. And what happened to the 11 people who were turned to stone when Medusa dropped her blindfold? I mean, the questions that you read the book go, huh, I didn't think about that. And it's brilliant. The book is, and here's my favorite description of Dr. Lowe, because in the appendix, under the male characters, of course, Dr. Lowe is the very first one. And it says, Dr. Lowe, a Chinese. That's it.
Yeah.
That's all they give you.
That's awesome.
That's all they give you. Highly recommended book. So really, I'm raving about the book here, folks. But the movie is, oh, it's one of my favorites. It's absolutely favorite. Tony Randall is brilliant. It gives you a great feeling. You leave that movie going, oh, I feel good about humanity, and I feel good about these characters. And it's just wonderfully done. Not a good adaptation of the book, of the source material. It takes the bare bones of it, tells a story, has to, I think, in terms of filmmaking and storytelling, you have to add something, a thread that goes through, in this case, the town of Abbott and this guy, Mr. Stark, who wants to buy other land and all that stuff. It's very typical, you know, the evil robber baron kind of thing. And you establish right. heroes and a librarian and these characters. But the book is surreal and was banned, actually, when it first came out. It was a banned book because there is a lot of sexuality in it as well, particularly with the satyr doing what it does. So there are my choices. Treasure Island, 1990. Again, a fantastic adaptation of a fantastic book. And The Circus of Dr. Lowe, a fantastic book with a fantastic adaptation that has nothing really to do with the book. I mean, it's very, very different.
Yeah. That's a great adaptation.
Yes.
If it works and the essence of the novel is there, and again, I love, in no small part because of Tony Randall, I love the character of Dr. Lowe. He's one of the most memorable fantasy film characters. And so for me, I'm like, wow, they got it. They did it. That's great. Yeah. You know,
allow me to very quickly redirect, Your Honor. Everything that you said is great. I'll tell you another example where this happens, where it's not so cut and dried. Okay.
Okay. Okay.
Conan the Barbarian.
Ooh. Okay. Yes. Go. No. Okay. But perfect.
We don't have another hour though.
We don't. We don't. You pick. That's perfect, Mark. You picked a good example. And by the way, I am including both the original Conan and then that horrible remake with the wonderful Jason Momoa. That was not true. It was not true to the spirit of the character and of the world.
Right.
And so whereas I think Momoa got it right, and to some extent Schwarzenegger got it right, the story in the let's stick with the first one. The story with
Schwarzenegger's, stick with the first one.
The story with Schwarzenegger's Conan is about as far from the spirit of a Robert E. Howard story as you could possibly get. With the whole the cult and the love child and oh, you know, this is how I can know how I control my people. Isn't it great? We're like hippies out here. And
as soon as you start with the idea that Conan has parents and he's going to avenge their death, you are in the weeds.
Yeah.
You know, that right there is you know, I mean, it starts on a fail, you know, rather than use anything from any villain from the Conan stories, we're going to go ahead and just borrow this Kull villain for our story.
Yeah. And then not even make him like a Robert E. Howard villain.
No.
But make him like this weird, you know, again, played brilliantly by James Earl Jones, given the material, but they turned him into something else. They turned that story into something else. You don't adapt the Punisher and make it a heartwarming love story.
Right.
You miss the point if you make a movie like Conan. That is not Robert E. Howard.
So I'm going to that movie is so much fun to watch.
If the story had ended with Thulsa Doom changes into a giant snake and Conan fighting this giant snake for this dramatic ending, would that have been more like Robert E. Howard?
It would have been a step closer.
But you still have to change so much. You have to change so much about everything that happens in the movie. Again, it should have been a really fun, you know, balls to the wall sword and sorcery action movie.
Right.
And instead, you get this sort of introspective journey to find yourself. Who am I? asks Conan.
John Milius.
Who am I?
John Milius doing his samurai epic. You know, it's his tribute to Kurosawa.
Mickey was trying to say something.
Oh, I was just wondering if the second one was closer.
Oh, don't talk. I'll come through this microphone and murder you.
Before we get to murder, let's move on and close this last session up of the Gentleman Nerds. I knew it was going to get passionate, ladies and gentlemen, but I didn't realize murder was on the table. And speaking of murder, if we don't wrap this up, we will be by Maximilian. Let's go ahead and tie this up into a nice knot. Ladies and gentlemen, the Gentleman Nerds is a Cloak and Dagger production and is written by Aaron D'Arrive, Mark Finn, Mickey Finn, and Joseph Botinos, with additional material provided by The Night King, Lex Luthor, and Saruman the White. Music composed and performed by the amazingly talented Ben Gibbs. Promotional material, logos, and the Gentleman Nerds mascot, who is still nameless, by the way, created by Goddess Michelle Fitzpatrick. The Lobach Lounge bouncer is Maximilian, and of course Jack Griffin is the Invisible One. Our sound editor and accidental producer is Mickey Finn. Our executive producer and the man that we all pray never gets superpowers is Aaron D'Arrive. And Mark Farnash is the man in the gorilla suit. Technical assistance provided by Blythe Christopher D'Arrive. Dynamation, created by Ray Harryhausen. And Raquel Browning plays the Gill Man underwater in all three films. Please join us in the Lobot Lounge next when we meet, and we'll have a seat at the table right here for you. This is Joseph Botinos. One last round, gentlemen. Final words. Mark, Finn.
You killed my mother. You killed my father. You killed my family.
Mickey Finn.
This is TV, but if you haven't been watching American Gods because you're on the fence, stop being on the fence and go watch American Gods.
Fie on that.
And Aaron D'Arrive.
And remember, folks, it is a successful adaptation if it's entertaining and true to the spirit of the material.
Amen. This is Joseph Fotinos reminding you all once again that Red Skull lives. Thanks, folks.
And Mark Farnash needs to stay the man in the gorilla suit. That's perfect.
He will always be the man in the gorilla suit.
Perfect. Yay. Yeah, yeah.
Do you want to retry the opening?